We have to be so available to what their unique experience is. No one in the world, no one in the universe ever, in history or in the future, will have that experience ever again. That is profoundly unique. The person's preciousness is absolutely incalculable. And that preciousness partly derives from the fact that they are the only person ever, sovereign, if you like, to live their life.
Welcome to Good Enough Counsellors, the podcast for growing a private practice without the pressure to be perfect. I'm Josephine Hughes, counsellor and creator of Therapy Growth Group, helping you get the clients you want and create the practice of your dreams. In today's episode, I'm talking to Nicola Blunden, a pluralistic therapist, trainer, and writer whose work explores how we listen, believe, and share power with our clients. She's especially interested in epistemic justice, the idea that we need to take seriously what our clients know about their own lives, especially when their voices have been marginalised or dismissed. Nicola teaches and trains on these ideas, and she has a new book coming out shortly called Co-Producing Counselling and Psychotherapy, Navigating Ethical Partnerships in the Therapeutic Profession. And she's the co-author of the third edition of Next Steps in Counselling and Psychotherapy Practice alongside Pete Sanders. I've been really looking forward to this chat with Nicola because her work really invites us as therapists to reflect on our own assumptions and find ways to practice with more openness, humility and respect. So Nicola, you're very welcome on the show. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you. That introduction, it's always interesting to hear yourself get introduced, but that you really kind of picked out the things that are, the values that are important to me. So I was very grateful for that. That might be the most accurate introduction I've had about in terms of what I'm interested in and what I care about. So yeah, thank you for that. That was a good welcome for me.
Oh, great. I'm really looking forward to just having this chat and allowing what you've been teaching and working about to reach my audience as well, because it's so important, isn't it? So I'm going to start with a quote, because a lot of people will probably need a bit of an explanation. And this I picked up from your LinkedIn. And you said, many therapists aren't aware of the epistemic injustices that they might perform in therapy. An awareness of social causes and consequences of epistemic injustice can help all of us to know, trust, believe, and respect our clients more deeply. So we're going to start there, and I'm just going to sort of kick it off by saying, can you explain what you mean by epistemic injustice in therapy?
Yeah, and it comes from a philosopher called Miranda Fricker, who is in kind of social sciences more broadly, and it's one of those ideas that it takes a few minutes to unpack, maybe, but I find that when people hear it, they go, oh yeah, that. You know, it's just the name for the thing that we kind of know exists.
Yes.
But she talks about that in society, where we have structures in society where there's already prejudice and bias against people. And we know, don't we, that that exists in society. Women are stigmatized. People with racial differences from ourselves might be stigmatized. People with disabilities and so on. We tend to hold biases. And that's a common kind of concept amongst most counsellors and therapists, I think. But she says that in a society where we have those perceptions of people that are prejudiced, we deny them a particular form of expertise. We deny those people their identity as epistemic agents. Mm-hmm. Epistemic means what we know or how we know, or the fact that we know something. Yeah. So she says that when we already maybe have a racialized perspective about somebody, we deny that person credibility. We deny them the right to describe their experience, or we doubt their description of their experience. And she calls that a testimonial injustice.
Yeah.
So a testimonial injustice would be when, you know, someone tells us what they know and we just don't believe them. We just mm-hmm. don't give them credibility for that perspective. We might think, oh, this person is a patient. What would they know about their experience compared to a doctor?
Yeah.
Or we might think this person is biased. They have a very particular experience. What would they know about XYZ. So it's a kind of, it's a denial of people's knowledge and a denial of their ability to be knowers about their own lives.
Mm-hmm. I mean, this just strikes so many chords in me because, you know, I'm sort of involved in supporting transgender people. And so much of the discussion at the moment doesn't centre. Their voices just don't seem to matter. And to me, that seems incredibly unjust, actually, you know, that all these decisions are being made about them without their involvement because of the inherent discrimination against them, I think. So, yeah, that's it really strikes chord.
And so Miranda Fricker describes this, that second form of injustice that you're describing there as hermeneutical injustice. So when we think about the hermeneutic is how meaning is made. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, many people listening to this will have, particularly if they're doing long essays or dissertations or research, they'll be thinking about counselling as a hermeneutic practice. It's a practice in which we make meaning with clients about themselves. Narrative therapists talk about this quite a lot, people who use creative practices. So a hermeneutic is kind of my understanding of myself in the context of the world. Well, when we deny people the right to be epistemic agents or the right to be knowers, what tends to happen is that the hermeneutic that we collectively make about them, the meaning that we make about them in society, is made without them. So in exactly the kind of obvious ways that you're talking about here with the Cass report and the Supreme Court ruling, people are physically, literally denied access to making that meaning. But also in our construction of what it means to be a trans woman, for example, most of that construction has been made by people who aren't trans.
Yeah.
And maybe in the medical field or maybe in political fields. And then people are, so that the meaning that is made about people when a trans woman perhaps for the first time is looking out there to think, you know, what do I relate to in society? How do I construct my feeling of being a woman, my feeling of femininity? The available models are just deficient. They just don't speak to that person's experience because they weren't made. They weren't constructed. The hermeneutic is really lacking. Mm-hmm. So then you have a kind of vicious circle that happens where the construction we make about a person doesn't involve that person. And people are further denied access to, and people contradict that hermeneutic. So when they describe their own experience and it doesn't quite fit, then that is used to deny their status as a knower even more. So a trans woman doesn't feel himself to be the way that society constructs them to be. That difference is also used to kind of deny their credibility.
And is that something that's sort of internalised in them? So if they sort of came for therapy, they would have internalised that sort of dominant narrative.
Yeah, they might question, you know, am I someone with a fetish, or am I someone who's aberrant, or am I somebody who, you know, has a problematic issue with my mum, or, you know, the kind of things that, when we pathologize, you know, we used to pathologize gay people very formally in the same way. And gay people, you know, we used to feel, was there something wrong with my upbringing? You know, mothers were blamed for creating gay sons, for example. You know, I laugh about that. It's actually quite a painful thing, but it feels almost ridiculous to us now.
But it's exactly what's said about mothers of transgender young people now. Yeah.
It is. And I would say mothers of children with disabilities. So, you know, we're seeing an increasing incidence in the UK of previously undiagnosed autistic kids and ADHD kids and dyslexic kids and, you know, other kinds of neurodivergence. And there's very often a pathologizing of the maternal relationship there as well. And unfortunately, we can look to some of our own history as counselors and psychotherapists and attachment theories and so on that are partly responsible for this kind of misunderstanding. Yeah. So you can see how people, as you say, they internalize this prejudice, this meaning that is made about them. And when we think about the words about them, so one of the things that's interested me always is co-production. And when I first trained as a therapist, I was actually a youth worker, and I used co-production a lot in my youth work. And the kind of the tagline, if you like, or the war cry, if you like, of co-production is nothing about us without us.
Yeah,
is this idea that, you know, we shouldn't ever create services, make sense of people, write reports about people, and not with those people, or actually not by those people.
So. Yeah, it's a really important phrase, I think, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Can you sort of give us some ideas of how it might show up in the therapy room? Obviously, we've talked about transgender people, but what other sort of situations might we need to be aware of that this epistemic injustice might show up, how it might show up?
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, this is something, you know, what I'm not claiming is that I think you can ever get to a point where you're not inadvertently perpetrating some epistemic injustice, because I think this is really about, at the level of society, what we tell each other about groups of people, yeah, and how that has become what we think is normal. And to some extent, all of us will have internalized various ideas about that. And I'm thinking about my own relationship with my disability. You know, I gaslit myself for a while about my own disability. And when I was diagnosed with my disability, which is a neurodivergence, I experienced kind of half relief and half fear about, yeah, about my, you know, I even at times told myself, no, you don't have that. You don't have that diagnosis. I mean, I really do. I really ticked all the boxes and some, you know, and my, yeah, I remember the psychiatrist who assessed me saying, yeah, no, you have very severe ADHD. Really? And he said, yes, really, you do. Yeah. There's a kind of common misconception, I think unfortunately reinforced in the therapy world, mm-hmm, that because some medical diagnoses, particularly mental health diagnoses, are problematic, right, that all diagnosis is unhelpful and problematic. Yeah. And that can feed into epistemic injustice here. So we might think, actually, no, ADHD isn't entirely real, or we might have internalized misconceptions about medication. So this is kind of just using my experience, really. I might do this to myself. Mm-hmm. And I may have, I really hope I don't do that to clients, particularly around neurodivergence, in which I've learned a lot. But before that, I might well have sat and thought, well, what would it, you know, how would it help you to get a diagnosis, really? Is it really that important? Well, I can now say, as a woman with a diagnosis, it was profoundly important for me, yeah, to get that diagnosis. It opened up, the main thing that it opened up for me was access to compassion towards myself.
Yeah.
It explained so many of the struggles that I'd internalized as personal failings for decades, yes, for my entire life. And now I was able to understand within a context of being different from how other people function. And that compassion in itself opened up, you know, uncountable numbers of doors around, yeah, learning how to work with myself differently, yeah, learning how to, and accessing support and describing myself to myself and others. And there's that hermeneutic justice. I was able to make meaning and sense of myself in a way that felt really true and felt very self-accepting. If a therapist assumes that a diagnosis is going to be unhelpful, that itself might be a form of epistemic injustice.
Yeah, and sort of maybe deny the client that freedom, in a sense, and the empowerment that actually getting a diagnosis might actually help them with. And yeah, again, that really sort of chimes with my experience with my kids, just sort of seeing the power of them acknowledging to themselves who they actually are. And also for me, I think as well, I think, you know, one of the things that really changed me as a parent with a child going through transition was really listening to other transgender people, because, you know, giving them the voice, allowing them to tell me what their experience was. It was about, you know, removing some of those assumptions and that, like you say, that sort of internalized assumptions about, and frankly, transphobia that I'd been sort of brought up with. I hadn't realized that it was there, but, you know, it, just listening to people made such a difference to me. And I think that's actually a lot of what's missing in the dialogue today, is that, and that's part of the injustice, isn't it? That people aren't being listened to, they aren't being heard. And consequently, there's a lot of assumptions being made about them.
There's a lot of people coming into debates around particularly very polarizing debates like trans issues, diagnosis, neurodivergence, and things like that. There's a lot of people coming in with a very closed opinion before they even enter the conversation. Mm. And as you say, that means that they're not listening. So they want to argue about what they think is a statement of fact, you know, what sex is real or whatever it is. And what that does is that closes down the phenomenology of the person in front of you. So if we think about the phenomenology of a person, it's our unique experience. You know, Carl Rogers talked about this phenomenal world that we experience is this very fluid arising of experience of, well, I should not say arising of experience, I don't want to kind of miscommunicate him, but phenomenal sensations, impressions arise within us and mm-hmm. arise outside of us. And we are meaning-making beings mm-hmm. that are always processing. So when we're sitting with a client, to be open to that phenomenal field with the client, to allow them to integrate their phenomenal experience and not deny their phenomenal experience, we have to be really almost infinitely open.
Yeah.
We have to be so available to what their unique experience is. No one in the world ever, no one in the universe ever, in history or in the future, will have that experience ever again. That yeah. is profoundly unique. And, you know, in the pluralistic community, we talk about an ethic of care. Mm-hmm. It connects to Levinas's position. Mick Cooper talks about this a lot. The person is a subject. You know, the person's preciousness is absolutely incalculable. Mm-hmm. And that preciousness partly derives from the fact that they are the only person ever, sovereign, if you like, to live their life.
Mm-hmm.
And so for us to come in to meet someone and already say, well, you can't tell me about this, and I'm not going to be open to believing that, and that is wrong before you even start, mm-hmm. shuts down their sovereignty and mm-hmm. just shuts down the opportunity to really meet them, which for me, that encounter is what therapy is all about, is mm-hmm. really to be receptive, to be impacted by somebody exactly as they are in mm-hmm. the moment, as their phenomenal field kind mm-hmm. of moves within them. I'm kind of gesturing everywhere because I really experience it as like a flow within a person, you know.
Yeah.
And that
yeah.
moment's never to be repeated either. So
yeah.
So the joy for therapy for me is to come in and be open to that field and really get a chance to behold it in someone. So
yeah.
I think you're right. It's about listening. And when you really listen in that way, it's quite hard to bring in ideological perspectives that say, oh, I'm not sure about that. You know, it's not a position of suspicion. Mm-hmm. It's a very open, believing, kind of credulous, if you like.
Yeah. I'm just sort of like listening and thinking, you know, what gets in the way of us having that really open attitude towards our clients? I don't know. I don't know whether this is true or not, whether they're almost like sometimes it's almost like we have something to prove, maybe to ourselves, or I don't know what you think. You know, what gets in the way of us being in that place of being really open to the other person's experience?
For me, it's fear.
Mm-hmm.
And so it might be fear that I'm not, you know, good enough.
Mm-hmm.
And I love the title of your podcast, because I think that knowing that I'm good enough is a position of openness to myself, right? Even though I know that I can always keep improving. So if I'm afraid that I'm not good enough, I might want to prove something. But I'm thinking about a very profound therapy relationship for me in which I feel like I learned this in a way that I'd never learned before, is working with somebody who has plural identity. So somebody who even still, unfortunately, in psychiatry might be described as somebody who has dissociative identity disorder,
mm-hmm.
even though actually they don't experience their plurality as being in any way disordered. And I envy it sometimes. I really, you know, because they have this capacity to figure things out within themselves as a group that, mm-hmm. you know, is profoundly, it's such an amazing resource. And actually, I'll talk about plural identity a little bit just to give listeners a kind of understanding of it. But essentially, mm-hmm. we all have, if you've done internal family systems theory, or you'll understand that all of us have different aspects of self. And we might call those configurations of self in the person-centered community. And those aspects of self, I might feel myself as quite a young version of myself, or a teenage, you know, foot stampy, or even self-protective version of myself, and different parts of myself might come forward. Somebody who experiences themselves as having plural or multiple identities has that natural facility that we all have to move between aspects of identity, but usually because of trauma, usually quite severe and enduring trauma in childhood, those aspects of self become quite fixed and separate from each other.
Mm-hmm.
So the person, particularly before they start to kind of become aware of each other, they may not be aware of each other, and they may have completely separate these parts of self within a person, separate names, separate memories, separate preferences, separate abilities. Some might be able to play an instrument while others can't. Some might be able to speak a language that others can't. They will have lived very separate lives. Mm-hmm. And previously in the psychiatric community, those people would have been either told that that was a fiction, that that mm-hmm. doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. And that was the belief for a while.
Yeah.
Or they would have been told that they were kind of incurable. Or they would have been told that they had to reduce all of those personalities down to one.
Right.
They call it integration. Mm-hmm. And that forced reduction of personalities usually means eliminating all of the beautiful facets of those personalities, and you're left with the one version of yourself, mm-hmm. which is not what human experience is. We all mm-hmm. have multiple facets of ourselves that are often contradicting each other. So when I first started working with a client who has plural identity, my main barrier was fear. My main barrier to listening to them was fear. And it wasn't fear of them, mm-hmm. although we're conditioned to be fearful of people with plural identities. But I knew the person well enough that there was nothing to fear in that person. It was fear that I would get something wrong. It mm-hmm. was fear that I would not help them, or that I might even make things worse for them, that maybe something that was happening that was out of control, that I didn't know how to control.
Yeah.
Anyway, over time, the client and I really learned how to work very safely with mm-hmm. the reality of their phenomenal experience. And I got to meet with that client, wonderful people that parts of themselves. Yeah, that I really think of as different people within a system. And you know, I can empathize with different parts of that in the same way as if you're working with a group, and you'll know if you've ever led a group that you can be aware of what multiple people are thinking at one time, and they might be thinking different things, but they're all important things. It's in the sharing those important things that you come to a new position that is good for everyone potentially. Mm-hmm. And that's my experience of working with people with plural identity. And I would say plural identity is much more common than we think. And when you're seen as safe by people with plural identity, because I've written actually some research with that particular client. Mm-hmm. Other people come and tell me that they're plural all the time. And it's wonderful to experience that. These are happy, healthy, you know, people in systems.
And I guess you just end up working with more people with that particular type of identity or identities. Yeah. And become more confident maybe with working with them.
Exactly, and a different way of being human. And I will say that actually that was probably my doorway to working with trans people mm-hmm. and non-binary people, because mm-hmm. not all the parts of a person, the outward version of the person that you may know that identifies with the biological features of that body, not every part in that system will. So there'll be male parts, female parts, non-binary parts, child parts, adult parts. These are all social constructions that are part of how we form identity. And I know that those parts are the gender that they are, and I experience them as that gender. And it makes no sense for me to deny someone's gender when I've had that very profound experience of working with someone who has boy parts and girl parts of self. And that's completely consistent and coherent. And I believe that is, you know, that's also my experience of them.
That's so interesting. So interesting. Because I'm sort of thinking for sort of trans clients who maybe sometimes move towards detransition, you know, that sort of whether there's all these different sort of parts involved really, and which part, you know, becomes uppermost, I suppose. I don't know if that would be how you'd describe it, but it's a sort of interesting thought.
Yeah, and it's an interesting, one of the interesting dilemmas that I think plural people experience, you know, because they may have different sexualities too. They may have no sexualities. They may be child parts that, you know, that it's not appropriate to have sexuality around. So it's kind of how, for that client, it's how they construct privacy and space mm-hmm. in the system so that people can live their lives. I think it's much more difficult if any of the parts of self experience dysphoria, you know, or feelings of discomfort in the body. But actually, I think that's one of those things that's individual for everyone, isn't it? And that's why epistemic justice is so important, mm-hmm. is that we believe people's lived experience.
Yeah.
We have to take it at face value. We have to believe people when they say, this is what it's like for me in my inner world, mm-hmm. and not come in with preconceived ideas of what it should feel like for them, mm-hmm. because there's infinitely different ways of being human. Mm-hmm. I don't know all those ways. I can't possibly know all those ways.
And so to be open to people, which, yeah, so I suppose sort of like just sort of going back to that question about how, what might get in the way, there's that sense of it being needing to maybe prove yourself, but also I think there's something very courageous about what you're saying is because there's that sense of, oh my goodness, you know, am I competent enough to hold this person? Can I help them or will I sort of cause harm? And it's interesting actually, because, sorry, it's just going to take me a moment to remember. I'm having a bit of a menopausal moment. I can't remember her name. It was Heather Dale who came onto the podcast to talk about ethics. She was talking about how, for her, it's sort of discovery. And yes, it is a fearful place, but it's about discovery. And it's about, you know, with every client, you're, you know, moving into a new phase of discovering something. And so although you feel there is that sort of edge of fear, it's exciting as well. It's not so much about fear as excitement, I think.
Yeah, and I do think, I mean, sometimes fear can be really helpful, can't it, in that it can signpost to us when maybe we are working outside of the limits of our competence, maybe, you know, and when you're working, for example, with somebody with plural identity, there are definitely risks. There is a trauma background and there are potentially quite big consequences for someone. If you rush a process, if you don't ground or if you don't find safe ways to contain the trauma, absolutely awful things can happen. So it's right to have a certain amount of caution. But from my perspective, my personal belief is that you have to negotiate that safety, not about the client, with the client. You have to trust when the, you know, it's a project for me and the client or clients in one person to figure out what is going to be risky here. What are the competences that I do need? What are the competences that you need? How do we make sure we make this safe? And how do we proceed really slowly so that we don't take steps into dangerous areas? Mm-hmm. And that's the case with any client, but particularly I think where there's trauma involved. Mm-hmm. So yes, you do have to be careful and you do have to be clear when you're working within your competence. But that's not just for me as a therapist to figure out. That is for me and the client to figure out about their phenomenal experience and what the risks are for them. And it's just a very careful, meticulous conversation that needs to take place, a very slow one and one that just repeats. You know, one of the things that I talk about is, particularly in the pluralistic world, and I've written about pluralistic, person-centered way of being, where I talk about metacommunication, which is something that others have talked about. But for me, metacommunication is this constant stream of how are we doing this therapy? Because we're both co-creating this.
Yeah.
And there's no difference in, I mean, there's a difference in the type of knowledge we have. I have certain knowledge from my experience and training and life. And the client has certain knowledge from their training and experience and life and mm-hmm. their phenomenal experience right now. And the pair of us have to work together. So it's and again, it's an epistemic justice issue. This isn't me making decisions for the client. And this isn't me just abdicating my responsibility and allowing the client to go where they go without my input, which I also think is a risk for particularly very non-directive person-centered therapists. Actually, this has to be a dialogue. And, mm-hmm. and we need to be figuring out between us how we're doing the therapy alongside doing the therapy.
Yeah. So that's the meta bit. Yeah.
And that's the meta bit. Yeah. Yeah. So when I'm working with someone, we need to know what's going to be most effective, what's going to be most safe. Mm-hmm. And my knowledge is important and their knowledge is important about that.
Yeah. Because I think it took me a while to sort of understand this concept of co-production, because and your upcoming book is about co-production, isn't it? And this is what you're talking about, isn't it? That did you want to sort of explain what you mean by the term co-production? Because I think that's probably better for you to tell me.
it comes from kind of health and social care. Why? Actually, it was first invented by an economist, a woman called Eleanor Ostrom, term, but it essentially means rather than services being done to people, mm-hmm. services are done by or with people. Mm-hmm. So if you think about a birth plan, if as someone who's going to give birth, you, mm-hmm. you get to sit down with midwives ahead of time and plan, this is the kind of birth that's going to be most meaningful to me mm-hmm. or most comfortable for me. And so a birth plan is an example of how a health professional and a receiver of care, if you like, works together to make a plan. And so co-production has really affected quite a lot of the medical, health and social care professions. Mm-hmm. And that's one way that you can see that. But you can also see that in the way people have a lot more autonomy now over decisions that are made about their healthcare. So co-production, I think as therapists, we think we co-produce all the time because we're always listening to the client. But actually, what we tend to do is do the same type of therapy over and over again mm-hmm. to different clients, mm-hmm. rather than start from ground zero with a client and think, right, this is how I would normally work. What are you experiencing and what do you need? And
yeah.
for me, that's where the pluralism comes in. It's really figuring out how to create a unique therapy every time, not me constructing that privately in my mind and going back and checking it out with my supervisor, mm-hmm. but me and the client in real time improvising a good way of having a therapeutic relationship. Mm. And that I think that's a slightly different way of understanding the therapeutic relationship or working alliance, mm-hmm. is that we're both experts here. It's not just that the client is an expert or just that I'm an expert. We're both experts and we are for the first time figuring out something brand new here that will never happen again with yeah. any other client. Does that make sense?
It does make sense, yeah. Yeah, I think so. We've just been talking about the fear of getting it wrong. And I know for so many therapists, that fear doesn't just show up in the therapy room. It shows up in how we build our practices too. If you're someone who holds back from putting yourself out there, maybe because you're worried about saying the wrong thing, or you feel unsure about what makes your voice valuable, then Therapy Growth Group is a place where you can get support without the pressure. It's a space to explore your marketing, your confidence, and your practice building in a way that feels authentic, ethical, and grounded in who you are. You can find out more at josephinehughes.com. And now back to Nicola as we move into a really important idea that she introduces, the race to innocence. Having watched your presentation, this is the task seminar, isn't it, that you gave that's available to people on YouTube. And I'll put the link to that in the show notes if anybody wants to know more, a bit more about epistemic injustice. You talked about the race to innocence. And I wondered if you could explain what the race to innocence is.
The race to innocence is something that I referred to in that seminar for the Therapy and Social Change group, which is, it was pointed out by Black feminist theorists. It's something about, I don't actually want to misrepresent what they said in that paper, but I'll speak from my perspective as a white woman. Mm-hmm. I think, and this might be challenging for white women to hear, and in some ways I hope it is, because it was challenging for me to hear and I needed to hear it. Do you remember there was the thing about, it was kind of went viral, this idea that what would you prefer to be stuck in the woods with as a mm-hmm. woman? You prefer to be stuck in the woods with a random man mm-hmm. or a bear. Mm-hmm. And almost without exception, women picked the bear, mm-hmm. which outraged quite a lot of men.
Yeah.
Because I guess what that very small thought experiment did was exposed how frightened women are of men.
Yeah.
Of course, we can put the proviso in, it's not all men, of course, and we all have men that we love. But unfortunately, that man, random man in the forest, could be that man.
Yeah.
Whereas a bear would be more predictable. Now, mm-hmm. at the same time, I follow a lot of Black therapists on various social accounts. And someone put out a question as to Black women, if you were in a boardroom setting, mm-hmm. would you prefer that the person who walked in was a white woman or a white man? Mm-hmm. And a lot of Black women therapists and people responding to that question picked the white man. Mm-hmm. And I felt that hurt. I felt that hurt because I feel myself to be innocent, right? I feel myself to be, I'm a woman. I'm a victim of rape culture and patriarchy. And by the way, I think men are also victims of patriarchy, but as well as gender diverse and gender questioning people. But mm-hmm. I really felt this, ouch, why wouldn't you pick me?
Yeah.
Now that's a very white woman response. That's the race to innocence. It's like, but I've never hurt anyone. You know, actually, I participate and I benefit from being white all the time. One yeah. of the ways that white women can weaponize their white womanness is we aren't given room in society to be super aggressive, potentially, or super angry or powerful. That's punished.
Yeah.
But what we can do is become weak. So in a conflict situation at work, I could weaponize my victimhood, if you like. I could cry. I could enlist quite a lot of support if I'm very upset, particularly if I'm very upset about what a black woman has said to me.
Yes, absolutely.
I'm likely to get all the sympathy.
Yes.
The black woman will be racialized, stigmatized as angry or as troublemaker or something.
Yeah.
So there's power that I can operate in that situation. That makes me more dangerous than the white man.
Yeah.
The white man actually doesn't see the black woman as any kind of threat and will just go about, you know, they'll just go about their privilege.
Mm.
So it's this idea that as therapists, as all of us try to claim a position of innocence in relation to all of this harm that's happening.
Yes.
And race for it and try and get, you know, on that podium.
Yeah.
Actually, we really have to be aware how we're participating in things that harm other people. And that needs to be our first observation. And the more uncomfortable I get about that, the more I can dispel some of that toxic thinking from my belief systems and become genuinely somebody that is safer to be around.
I think it's just such an important thing for us to acknowledge, isn't it? Because I think we often, particularly maybe as women, you know, do see ourselves, I mean, it's not to say women aren't victimised, but we do often see ourselves as victims. And it's really interesting because I've really enjoyed reading Robert DiAngelo's White Fragility.
Mm.
And that's the sort of situation I think you're talking about where the white woman, when accused of being, of saying something racist or whatever, can fall back on that sort of female vulnerability and gain support. And meanwhile, the person who's black, as you say, can be seen as the aggressor, and yet it's using our white power, really, in a sense. And I think it's really important for us to be aware of that. But I think what I really liked about the White Fragility book is just acknowledging the fact that we grow up in a racist society. And so most of us don't want to think of ourselves as racist, but it's almost like this is part and parcel of who we are because of our society, because of all those inherent assumptions. And I think it makes it easier to admit to ourselves that we're racist if we acknowledge that we've been brought up in that sort of racist society and that we need to address that in order to right those historical wrongs, really. But I think we have such a lot of shame around it that we don't tend to acknowledge it. And I think the same is true, you know, around all sorts of minority issues, really, in that we don't, I think, especially because it's almost like a condition of worth, isn't it, that as therapists, you know, we shouldn't be racist, we shouldn't be transphobic, all these shoulds, and so we tend to push that away from ourselves rather than acknowledging that this is actually, you know, part and parcel of almost who we are by virtue of all the assumptions that we've grown up with, really.
We live in a society that's been entirely colonized by a particular mindset that started in the Enlightenment era. So this is at the time when, you know, Britain and other countries were conquering the world. Mm-hmm. They were conquering it with a very particular brand of what is good and right. And cognitive knowledge, male aggression, you know, physical might, and all of that is actually very local and very historical, but we presented it as a universal fact.
Yeah.
And we're still living in the echoes of that, what we thought of as universal fact, that male knowledge was definitely better, that emotionality was worse, that, you know, all of the stuff that goes along with the industrial military complex and capitalism of that project. So we're in it. We're already in it. It's all around us. It's part of, you know, everything that we've been conditioned in. Those conditions of worth are very strong in us and have been for a very long time.
Yeah.
And then we've exported that all over the world. So somehow we have to disentangle ourselves from all of those assumptions that push people to the edges of what we've been told is centrally important.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's not one person's fault. It's not my fault, but it is my responsibility. And also, it's a joyful thing. It's a joyful thing to let go of those assumptions and to discover. You talked about discovery earlier.
Mm-hmm.
To discover the reality of a person beyond all of those assumptions.
Yeah. And,
you know, when we don't get out of that box that we've been put in, the world is a much less beautiful place. So I think when people think about the left or they think about the woke agenda, I think they see us, or perhaps I'll put myself in that box, they see us as quite joyless. Mm-hmm. But actually, there's something beautifully convivial about seeing the world not through the lens of the colonial patriarchal mindset.
And celebrating each person. I think that's part of what comes in it for me, is the joy of actually seeing people fully and completely, you know, a whole people, and the joy of actually meeting someone as a whole. You know, I don't know if that works pluralistically.
Well, it does because this is about being community. So the book that you mentioned earlier, the Next Steps, the new Next Steps book, which is aimed at students really on diploma courses and degree courses, but really anyone could read it to update.
Yeah.
But I talk about Ubuntu in there quite a lot, which is this kind of sub-Saharan African value system that is sharing and is about conviviality and is about, you know, when they think about music, they don't think about something that's written down and commodified and is done by one person. They think about how we collectively create music in the moment together and we share what we have, because when I have surplus one day, I won't the next day. And so we collectively own things. This isn't the same as Marxism. It's not the same as communism. This is a value system that's about respect and about seeing ourselves as embedded within each other, that I make sense of myself because of you and because of us. And, you know, that's a joyful way of living. That's not a punishing, you should do it this way way of living. It's the opposite of that. It's very welcoming and loving. And, you know, so for me, dismantling colonial ideas, patriarchy, cisnormativity, heteronormativity, ableism, all of that stuff that we talk about is not about taking stuff away. It's about giving me access back to my humanity and my living in community with people.
Yeah.
And that is just the most precious thing ever. You know, it's just infinite gain in a way. So people are afraid of that. That's when people moralize, you know, that this isn't about moralizing. This is about invitation.
Yeah.
Back into who we really are.
Yeah, it's wonderful. It sounds amazing. Just wanted to sort of finish with a couple of questions, really, just to bring things to a close. So for therapists listening who are thinking, I don't want to cause harm, but I'm not sure about where to start, you know, because we've all got to start somewhere, haven't we? What would you say to them?
Well, in terms of epistemic justice, just notice when your client is telling you something and a part of you doesn't believe them. I'm not talking about when a client is actively lying about something, right? Or you know, a part of the client is manipulating something or they're covering up something. I'm talking about when that person is opening up their real lived experience. They're telling you, you know, I've actually never identified with myself as being a woman. I've always felt that I feel closer to being a man. Or if they're saying, you know, there are these traits that my friend thinks I might be autistic and I'm not sure, but I've always had this feeling of exclusion in groups, or I've always felt like, or, you know, they're saying to you, well, whatever they're saying to you, or they might be saying to you, you know, I was assaulted. And a part of you may just not doubt, just not believe what they're saying, just doubt what they're saying a little bit. A part of you is pushing back against it. Just notice that within yourself.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm a big believer in presence and mindfulness. So just allow that. Just notice, okay, there's a part of me that's not quite hearing or not quite giving them credibility here. I wonder if that's because of internalized messages. I wonder if that is just my assumptions. I wonder if I can open up to it a little bit more. So I think this is about an in-the-moment practice of, I'll put all that stuff outside that I've been told about X topic, and I'll leave that outside the door, and I'll just sit with this person's experience and just open myself up to it, and I'll notice when I don't quite believe it. That's my advice. And if you do that consistently enough with someone, they will tell you what their phenomenal world is like, and it will be compelling, and you will believe them. And regardless of what people say out there, if they experience themselves in a way that is different from what other people say, there's no debate about it. That just is what it is. That is the person's life. and their world, and it's unique. So yeah, so it's about just noticing where external ideas have cropped in, really. Yeah.
Because, I mean, part of me thought then that what you might say, and it always feels like it's a really big thing to do, would be to sort of go away and study more about, I don't know, say disability or something like that. So it's actually really interesting to hear that answer is actually, no, it's just about being in the moment, about just bracketing off those, your own assumptions, really, and just listening. Yeah.
Yeah, because wherever a belief contradicts with what the client is saying, I'm going to go with what the client is saying.
Yeah.
I'm not going to go with a belief from outside.
Yeah. Yeah. That's fantastic. Thank you. And finally, if there's one change you'd love to see in how therapists think about knowledge, power and trust in the therapy room, what would it be?
I think it would just be to recognise that one of the ways that society harms people is in denying them this status of being able to describe their experience and being able to speak to their experience and to be trustworthy. Just to notice that exists in society, and it's the fundamental way that most of the harms happen to people.
Mm-hmm.
Is that they're denied as agents of knowledge. This is a colonial idea. Only certain people have knowledge, and they're usually the rich, powerful men with the credentials, right? So this applies to lots of people. And then just notice, how am I denying this person's status as a knower? And actually, how much of that is just a condition of worth I've internalized that I could let go of? So that's all. Just people being aware of that interaction, I think, would be really helpful. And it would make us all less likely to go online and go, I think, da, 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 da.
Yeah.
Because, what I think is one thing, a person's lived experience is another. And that is absolutely important to me, the client.
Yeah. It's really about sort of respectfully centering their experience, isn't it, from what you're saying?
Yeah, and noticing where I don't, and then, as you say, bracketing that, because it's something that happens to all of us all the time. We do it to ourselves. Maybe that's a good place to start. Notice how you talked about menopause before. As menopausal women, we dismiss our own symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
Notice how we make ourselves, notice how we perpetrate epistemic injustice upon ourselves too. We deny what we know.
Mm-hmm.
And then we deny what other people know.
Mm-hmm.
Just to be aware of that process, I think, would be wonderful.
Yeah, brilliant. Oh, it honestly, we could carry on talking, couldn't we?
Yeah.
It's been so interesting just to have that little bit of light cast on into this area. So thank you so much for being part of it, and really looking forward to sharing the episode with people.
Thank you so much for having me, and I'm excited to be here, and I really enjoyed the conversation. I really appreciated your questions. It was a real pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. Do come and join my Facebook community, Good Enough Counsellors. And for more information about how I can help you develop your private practice, please visit my website, josephinehughes.com. If you found this episode helpful, I'd love it if you could share it with a fellow therapist or leave a review on your podcast app. And in closing, I'd love to remind you that every single step you make gets you closer to your dream. I really believe you can do it.